Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 129 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Often on Caro Pop, we talk with artists who are looking back on amazing careers, but this week we talk with someone who is looking forward to one, Nico Capitan of the band Freako. The Chicago-based Freako is, as they say, one of the hot buzz rock bands of the moment. I was hearing its song Crimson to Chrome on the XMU satellite station about a year ago, even though its debut album, Where We've Been, Where We Go From Here, didn't come out till this February. That album, released by the high-powered indie label ATO Records, has been getting raves and more widespread airplay. Pitchfork wrote, "Where We've Been, Where We Go From Here isn't just a throwback. It carries the spirit forward, reaffirming that indie rock as a style and ethos can still feel like the most exciting thing a young person could be into." Capitan's voice covers a huge musical and emotional range, delicate and fragile one moment, fierce and roaring the next. The band is just as dynamic as it shifts from loud to quiet, melancholic to joyful. The songs move from the haunting piano ballad For Ella, to the syncopated supercharged chemical, to the bleak, anthemic Get Numb to It. At the Great Northside Club Metro served as a coming out party for the band, with a young and old crowd singing along with each of Capitan's deeply felt songs. Freako recorded the debut album as a trio of friends from Evanston Township High School. Frontman Capitan, drummer Bailey Minzenberger, and bassist Luke Stamos, who has since left the band. Freako now is a duo of Capitan and Minzenberger, with other musicians augmenting the live lineup. As an Evanston native myself, I'll note that I've been hearing about Capitan's talents for a while. My good friend Dan plays in a funk rock band, Chicken Bone, with Capitan's father, Dimitri, a guitarist. Dan would tell me about this talented kid who was making music while at Haven Middle School, which I also attended, and the high school. Capitan's high school band, the Marquees, got things started. Go on YouTube and you can check out studio and live performances of Capitan's early standout song, Holdin' On People. Freako went further, developing its chops and growing its audiences over a few years of club performances and the release of two EPs. ATO signed the band last August, by which point they'd already recorded Where We've Been, Where We Go From Here. Now they've embarked on a months-long tour and will be playing Lollapalooza in Chicago's Grant Park in early August. In the wake of Freako's South by Southwest performances and his triumphant Metro appearance, Capitan reflected on where he's been as a songwriter and musician. Why did he learn drums first, and how did that rhythmic basis affect his songwriting? How has Freako developed such a strong sense of community? Are the rock scenes out of Chicago and Evanston as supportive as they appear? How did he develop his unique sense of song structure? Is his happy place more in the studio or on stage? Has his label made suggestions about how to approach the second album? About which album does he say, "You don't get any better than that"? Where do they go from here? We're eager to find out. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Nico Capitan.
I don't know.
I had just been at Music Direct that afternoon, hanging out in the record room with Rob Gillis and kind of looking around, and I bought my stereo equipment from them, and I'm friends with him, and Bess installed it in our house. And I'm like, "What are you doing here?" And he's like, "Nico works there. I'm like, "Really?" Like, I had no idea. So I've probably like seen you like in the hallways or like in that back. I don't know if you're in that warehouse or a different one, but.
No, I'm in that warehouse. I've been there for 3.5 years now. I mean, I'm more in the back where we receive. I'm not really up front where all the records are, but where people shop. But yeah, I've been there for a while now.
That's kind of a happy place for me. I just like having all these records around and audio equipment. It's just sort of, especially like during the pandemic, where that's when I had the same turntable I had from high school, and I finally was like, it's time to upgrade it. You know, I'm not going to shows. I need to do something. And then of course, then I just keep having to feed it by getting more and more records. But anyway, so
it got so busy. It was so busy during the when COVID was hardcore because everybody was like, just, yeah, they're like, well, I'm stuck at home. I better upgrade the shit. And now it's slowed down a lot, but it was busy then. Yeah.
Well, that seems like it's like if you're going to have a day job doing what you do, that seems like that would be a good one to have.
Well, especially they've been so not, like, they're actually letting me work too, like in between tours this year. And we're on the road for like 5 months out of the year. So yeah, they've been very good to me. Bez is a really nice guy to me.
Yeah, no, they're a bunch of nice guys there. I just like hanging out there, you know, aside from then coming home with more records than I should. But so what was like the first instrument that you learned? Because I think you were a drummer early on. Like what was your musical evolution in terms of learning instruments and then starting to write songs?
Yeah. So in fifth grade, I expressed interest in the drums. And so my parents got me like a starter Pearl kit for Christmas. And I played that in Opening Doors, which was the cover band, in middle school and like early high school that we did. And we would literally just play block parties and an old neighborhood grill when that was around.
Right.
Yeah. And I did drums forever and I really loved drums. I just got to a point where I started like writing stuff and I just enjoyed writing songs more and you just, yeah. And so I'd still play drums on like all the recordings at the beginning because I would just do everything on those, but I just slowly sneaked away. And now that we have Bailey, I don't really ever need to play the drums much.
Right. When you started writing songs, were you writing them on an instrument or were you sort of drumming and then kind of like coming up with stuff? And then you're like, oh, you know what? I need to learn how to play guitar and piano or whatever else.
So I just like picked up a guitar at a random point because I started using GarageBand, which I eventually got Logic Pro X, but, and I would just make like loops and they were almost just like indie type beats type stuff. Cause they're just guitar tracks with like some like shittily recorded drums. But I started writing for years. My writing process was literally just like come with a small idea and like make loops. I mean, Burnout Beautiful, that first like demos album that I recorded in my parents' basement in Evanston, that was all like looping stuff and like, and making drums and like recording drums myself. All in like Logic Pro X and stuff. That was the core of it. Just those home DAWs, which are so essential now to people my age coming up making music.
Would you come up with the whole musical bed first and then start in on, you know, what's the song about, coming up with the lyrics and that sort of thing, like music first?
Yeah. I mean, back then, I don't think I was thinking too much about what it's about. It would just be like, if the words sounded right and like, yeah, I mean, it would be so sporadic. It would be so random because like when you're a kid and you have Logic Pro X and you can do anything, any amount of tracks, any instruments, I would just toy around with it for hours and hours. And it would just be completely different every time an idea came around.
So how has that sort of evolved to this point? Do you write similarly now or do you have a different process?
Now is mostly I will come up with ideas on vocals and guitar, vocals and piano. I've been starting to think about getting more into the recording. We might try that with the producer for a few songs in September, like starting from that like small idea and then in the studio with that small idea. But I've, for this record, the debut and like a lot of stuff, I've really enjoyed like trying to be like an actual songwriter in like the classic sense and just like really focus on song structure and lyrics and like that holding up, because then if you have that fully fleshed out as a song, then the recording process is so much more fun because then it's just like, how do we hold up this as a song, you know, not overdo it, not underdo it.
Yeah. Your sense of structure is like really interesting. I was, you know, I've listened to the album a bunch of times and I've seen you. I feel like your songwriting kind of comes at things like they're sort of like elements that are familiar and that there are songs and, you know, there are hooks and melodies and rhythms and a lot of rhythmic interplays. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that you started as a drummer because you got a lot of cool rhythmic things going on. But, you know, like something like Chemical, it builds up to this chorus, but then the chorus doesn't come back. It's just like the one chorus and, you know, Get Numb to It also, it builds up to this like big chorus that you repeat, you know, with a really great, you know, sort of lyrical hook, too, where like, you know, it doesn't get better. It just gets twice as bad because you let it. So you better get numb to it. But it's only at the end of the song. And a lot of songwriters, especially if you're sort of calculating for what makes a pop song or a hit song, you would have sort of planted that a minute into the song and then you would have come back to it. But you're just, your stuff has more sort of a organic flow to it where you're not it feels like it's coming to you instinctually, but not kind of in a calculated way. Does that sound right?
Yeah. I mean, that comes from writing stuff, I think, in Logic Products for so long, like not starting off like how to write a classic song, you know, because like I've never really been able to write the type of song where it's like a consistent, like where you can have the choruses in the predictable places, which like I want to try and do some more because I love a lot of songs like that. But I try to make up with that. I feel like with like, I mean, my love for like Pet Sounds, the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson is so incredible. It's just the repeated outros, and you can make up for having no choruses by just having a fucking a minute and a half long outro with a repeated hook, you know, because that just, then you leave people here and that, and they're like, they feel like they listen to three choruses, you know. It's an interesting effect.
It really wasn't until I actually watched like like live clip of you guys doing Chemical, and I was like, they really only do that chorus once. It sort of stands out so much in my memory of that song, you know, kind of the back and forth on the vocals. You know, when I was listening to the album again, I was like, oh, you know, getting numb to it also. It only, I think of it as having this chorus because you repeat it at the end, but it really is only like, it's almost a coda, even though it's also a chorus.
Yeah,
and it's interesting because it does stick in your mind as this, you know, killer chorus.
Yeah. It's just part of the outro. Outro is my favorite thing.
have you done much studying of music theory and songs and stuff like that?
I took a class in high school. I mean, I've done enough of my own studying and just like looking into things and trying to learn how stuff works, but no like formal studying really.
What was the first song you wrote that got you excited?
I mean, the first song when I was 17, when I wrote Holding On People, and that's the one song that we still play today. And that was the first one that I wrote where it's like, you know, like the friends around me, like some people at high school, ECHS were like, oh, I like fuck with the song. I'm like, oh, whoa, people actually like this one. And that was the first one with like a memorable actual chorus.
Right.
And so that was definitely, and that was the first one we started playing live. And like the first one people would know when we played that live in high school. So it's definitely that one. Yeah.
So that's Holding On People. And you were in a band then called The Marquees. So that was a different band. I was on YouTube and I listened to the studio recording of that. And then there's a version of you guys doing that at Space where there's this long sax solo at the end, which is pretty cool also.
Oh, crazy. That's old too. That's funny.
That was like 2019. So like, were you opening for someone at that one or?
No, we were playing with Bailey's band. I think we were opening for Bailey's band, Bailey Nunzenberger.
Oh,
and that was before Bailey was playing in our band, but yeah. So that's crazy, yeah.
It seems like you guys have a really great network of bands around here. Like that Space show, you know, it seemed like all the bands really, you know, supported each other and you guys all knew each other. Like Free Range was in that show and Bailey was playing bass, I think. And then you had Neptune Core and Smut at Metro, and everyone seemed like they were all, it gives the impression that you're coming out of a very supportive scene, which, you know, Chicago isn't always known to have had. Like there have been certain times where in the 90s where there were a lot of bands coming up, but there was also the sense of kind of rivalry there. Like, are things nice now?
I mean, from our viewpoint, the bands we know in the scene we're in, I mean, there are, you know, 20, 30 bands that we know, all very kind people and very talented. And there's a lot of people coming up right now, you know, too, that are very good. Like bands you mentioned, it's just a unique thing. Cause like, I mean, everybody kind of wants to have that scene thing. Like when I think of scenes and like thinking back in history with like cool music scenes, like, you know, Chicago in the 90s had the whole big scene that. And yeah, there is just a sense of like community within it instead of competitiveness for some reason. I don't know. I think it's just like starting with a good group of people and then it kind of goes from, it's a lot of luck. It's just seniness. It's like the zeitgeist. It's definitely, it has to do with post COVID for sure. A lot of people say about moving during that time. Chicago's the big city with like cheapest rent out of New York, LA and Chicago, and even like Austin or something, Nashville. So yeah. A lot of factors play into it.
Do you feel like growing up in Evanston that also kind of helped nurture your creative, you know, ideas and stuff?
I think having my close group of friends when we played cover stuff was great. I will say with Evanston, I wish they opened an actual cool rock venue. I think space is that, and space is the closest thing to that. But I wish they had like an empty bottle type, like college down and dirty type venue, you know? Maybe one day we can help build that, but
that'd be cool.
Yeah. Cause I mean, it's a college town, you know, and like space is fantastic and I love all the people that work there, but like, you know, there should be a space that's like really college based, and young people based. And I didn't feel like I had that growing up. Old Neighborhood Grill was honestly the spot where like we'd play all the time. Like friends would come out from high school. And Bailey was in a lot of the ETHS school stuff. Sadly, I was not, but yeah.
Did it help, by the way, having your dad in a band?
I mean, he was always playing guitar when I was growing up, and that was kind of what, you know, made me want to pick up a guitar. And seeing him play when I was like really young was definitely inspiring. And yeah, I mean, and him and my mom were always so supportive of me doing it. And even up to this point when it's like the scariness of making an actual career, that they're completely supportive. Yeah.
What was the point where you thought, I want to make an actual career of that, as opposed to this is just kind of something I'm doing on the side?
I think in 2019, I went to Columbia College for 1 year, and then Columbia College Chicago, and I dropped out because it just wasn't for me. And I was kind of at the point where I was like, there is nothing else that I really get anything from other than music, so I'm just going to go for this full time. So I got the job in Music Direct in the warehouse and just started doing music. Moved out of my parents' place, and yeah, I've been working there for 3 years since and just working on music.
Has it gone kind of how you expected it to go? I mean, it seems like, you know, it's one of these things where on the outside, it looks like you've had this really fast rise. And on your side, it probably feels like you've just been working hard for a long time.
Yeah, it definitely like, cause it was years of like cold emails, you know, and like practices and shows with nobody there. And like so much time, like 2 or 3 years, like under the table trying to do stuff. And at times I like, it got really frustrating. I was like, it doesn't feel like it's going to happen. But now, like, since the record came out, there's so many people being like, you know, like being like, well, this is happening so fast. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it does feel like it accelerated a lot since the record came out, but it was a very slow buildup for us.
Right. Well, it was interesting because at the Metro show, I started off in the balcony and I was actually sort of standing behind your parents were at a table and chatted and said hello.
Yeah.
And then at some point I went down and the thing that really struck me when I got downstairs was how many people of many different ages were singing along with the songs. Like they knew the songs, and it wasn't just from the record. It was also because they were the ones who, in that accumulation of all those shows you did, they got on board and it sort of hit critical mass at some point. And I don't know if you have like a sense of like when it hit critical mass, but it seemed like, oh, this is like, they have that thing now where people are like singing along with songs from an album that just came out.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely when the record came out, it was kind of like that moment it felt like. And like, we kind of felt that would be the case because with the singles us releasing, they are kind of all over the place if you just listen to them as singles, but like you kind of need the whole record, I feel like, for this one to kind of understand where it's coming from, if people are going to understand it. But yeah, it definitely was that slow accumulation. And it was Chicago, at least, you know, like, I don't know with us playing all over if people know anything from the EPs, like Hold On People or Not, but like with Chicago, it was a very, very, very slow burn. But it was truly like no one, and then getting like 10 or 15 people coming to 30 to 50 to 100. It was like there was a very marked slow burn. And like, you know, last year with Empty Bottle, like we sold 200 tickets, which is great, but like we didn't sell out Empty Bottle, you know. It was like, it was a slow burn for sure.
What did it feel like doing that Metro show? Because that was a big crowded show at a place where, you know, I mean, I saw Smashing Pumpkins open for the Buzzcocks in the same spot I was watching you guys. And that was before they got big.
That was our favorite show we've ever played. Mine, no doubt. It was very cathartic. And just like seeing so many familiar faces and a lot of familiar faces from them, the township that I did not expect to see, which is really funny and sweet. But yeah, it was a dream come true because so many, Metro did a really good job of documenting their shows in like the 90s and stuff. In 2000s. So on YouTube, you can find all the shows. So I've watched a lot of those.
So you did the Metro show. And then you went down to South by Southwest, where you're not playing for people who are singing along. You're playing for people who you're trying to introduce yourselves to. Like, how do you approach those shows differently? And what was that experience like?
We don't really approach any differently, luckily, because I mean, we're so used to that because it's been years of that, of like trying to convince people. And we did South by last year, so we kind of knew what it's like and like how like cutthroat and like fast it is. And like, you know, you hop up on stage, you get there 5 minutes before you hop off and you play and then you hop off, which is a different kind of adrenaline. And it was fun. It was a good time. It was very hectic. And like, I'm still recovering from that because we've still been going at it since that. But yeah, South by is definitely a different thing. We did all unofficial showcases, so we actually made some money because they paid. So it was nice. But
yeah, yeah, I used to go all the time, but it's been a while, and it seems like the unofficial stuff and the daytime stuff has kind of eclipsed the official nighttime stuff now. How many shows did you guys do?
We did 9 shows in 6 days.
Yeah.
But okay, South by has just gone too corporate. It's just like insane. The whole thing with the Army this year, it's like, you're not a music fest anymore, but something else will form around that time of year, I think, you know, for like music in Austin. But I honestly think South by is kind of, unless they completely change their ways, they're going to kill themselves completely.
Mm. And you guys are doing Lala also.
Yes. Yes. Very excited for that.
Do you know when you're, what day you're on, what stage you're on, any of that stuff yet?
I don't know that. Well, I think we're on the stage that's, when you walk, it's the one not facing the sun. That's what I know. It's the one with the two stages across from each other, and it's the one not facing the sun. I don't know if you know the one like across away from Perry's.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That makes it, so like on Hutchison Field, but on the south field, because it's got the two ones there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. On Saturday, yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, Saturday is a good thing. Are you looking forward to that?
Yeah. Oh, very much so. That'll be a dream come true for my school, especially.
Do you go to Lala?
I used to go in high school. I would not probably go anymore as just a listener, but I'm very excited to go as like an artist, and be able to like get to the, go backstage instead of have to go through the crowds all the time. But I had some fun times there in high school, a lot of shenanigans and yeah, good times.
What were your highlights at going to Lala?
When I was in high school, I mean, I remember, so I saw the drums, saw Arcade Fire, I saw Kendrick Lamar. I mean, honestly, I had some fun times at Perry's, just like the mosh pits and all that. What else did I see? I've never seen the Shins, all the Killers. They just have so many like the huge name bands that you see from like 300, 400 feet away, which is awesome, but
right,
it's just like a big scale thing.
Is there a concert that you can think of that kind of, you know, especially inspired you to want to do this, where you're just like, oh my God, I need to be part of that?
I was saying, I mean, when I saw Arcade Fire, Lollapalooza, a really touching one for me in high school.
What was the first big show you went to?
The Who at Allstate Arena.
Oh, wow.
That was funny. I mean, that was good, but I can't gauge. I was really young and like, they were already so old, but legends, you know, we were like nosebleeds, but definitely remember it.
Is there anyone who you're like, oh, now that I'm in a rock band and we're on our way up, is there anyone you want to especially meet, you know, or open for?
I was talking about this with someone last night at the show. I mean, the dreams are like, they're like top dreams. I mean, Radiohead is like number one for like a band that's legendary, but also still really cool and does cool stuff. I always say the number one, probably for most people, where like I'd freeze up and just start crying on the spot, would be Paul McCartney. Mm. And because I was talking to Terry from 93XRT last night, because she was there, and because we did that pop-up show at Reggie's, and she was telling me a story about, she interviewed Paul McCartney in 1975 before their first Wings tour. And she was just saying how like she was like completely mystified by it. And yeah, it's such a, just, that would just be the craziest thing. But like younger bands, I was thinking of like Geese. We've been talking to them. They seem like cool folks and make cool music. Black Country New Road, I love. I recently was able to talk to like Isaac Brock from Modest Mouse, and that was a dream come true, because I mean, especially writing this record, The Lonesome Crowded West was like one of my like biggest influences for this record.
Oh, interesting.
It just, he perfect that band. They like in that time period perfectly encapsulated like 20s angst, and he was just like so. Yeah, she's so poetic with it too.
I got that album recently. I didn't have it, and I kind of went back and got it. It's a pretty cool record. It covers a lot of ground too. It's got a lot of energy.
It's a crazy record. No other record sounds like it.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. As the weather warms up, Revolution's premium lager, Cold Time, really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slow, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. Still writing, like while you're really, really busy and you're about to go on tour for a couple months, do you write during those times? Did you sort of set aside time to write when you have a little more of a break?
I mean, yeah, writing is always like something that like I will. I don't know. I just like whenever I have downtime, I tend to do it more. It's more productive, and like I've been doing that. I've been constantly thinking about it, and, like especially the past few weeks, I've been doing a good amount of it because I when I think back to it, I'm like a lot of times when I'm writing stuff, I come up with ideas. And then set them aside and then keep coming up with more ideas. And then those come back and then they set aside again. Everything just slowly comes along and just like trying to like constantly work at it to slowly build that up again. Cause yeah, it's very daunting. Like, especially now since the first record got attention, like just want the second record to just be like incredible and blow it out of the water, even though we love this first record, but yeah, just got to work hard at it, you know, and stay down to earth and we'll be good.
So do you have songs written for the second record?
No, I'm not a prolific songwriter. We have some B-sides that'll be for this first record, but like anything, I'm not the type that'll be like, oh, let's just bring those over to the next record. Like the next record, I don't want us to be like a D'Angelo and release a record like every 6 years, but like every record, like formal record needs to be like a statement, like a huge statement piece. It's not just like a, you know, we're not like King Gizzard, who I love, but you know, we're not just going to release like three albums in a year and stuff. Just not the type of band that we are.
Back in like the sort of the golden era of like the 60s stuff, you know, you had this kind of, you know, album era, right? Even 80s. And then the CDs came around and then you had everyone making these like hour long CDs that were, you know, would have like 15 songs and, you know, five of them would be like, yeah, I don't know about that. Oh, then there was like iTunes and it was all just about like what tracks you're releasing and the singles didn't even matter. I mean, like the albums didn't even matter. But now with vinyl back, it seems like more people are thinking about albums and, you know, your album feels like an album. It doesn't feel like, oh, here's like a bunch of songs that you should have recorded. And now you just sort of put them together. The pacing of it and the shape of it and the sequencing feels like you conceived it as one album as opposed to a bunch of songs. So is that how you approach it? Are you like an album first guy?
I mean, I appreciate them. And we, the interesting thing is we didn't go into these songs and this like album thinking like we're going to record an album. It was more just like, we had some new songs. Like, we had Crimson of Chrome, Frell and Cardinal. And we were recording these B-side tracks that I was talking about. And then Scott Tellerita, I showed him Crimson of Chrome, Frell and Cardinal. And he was like, these songs are so much better than these. We need to work on these now and drop everything else. And luckily he was right. And then from there, you know, more songs just kept popping up. And we got lucky that everything came together and it was an album. But like, I do like to think that comes from like I grew up loving albums as a whole and always listening to those and like how classic albums work and like what makes an album classic and like even like more modern ones. Like, I mean, for me, modern day stuff comes from more like hip hop or R&B stuff, like Blonde by Frank Ocean or like, you know, To Pimp a Butterfly, like really classic shit.
Right.
Whereas like this is a huge statement piece. And obviously those are a different scale. And like that's something that we will be striving for forever. But like, you know, you need a more than one or two songs to like get into like a true mood and make a real like statement. So we'll definitely, we want to like think about that more with the second record with like, cause you know, the first record was 9 songs, 36 minutes, I think. So it's like, which we wanted to have a short debut. I always love the short debut. So many of my favorite debut albums are like under 40 minutes, but you know, to make like a more whole statement needs to be longer, which is a funny thing to say, but yeah.
Right. Well, you could do the sort of the Smashing Pumpkins thing where you got Gish, which is like your indie album. And then you got Siamese Dream, which is a leap. And then all of a sudden you're doing the big double album with the unwieldy title, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. So is that the trajectory you guys are looking at?
I don't know, man. Siamese Dream. I mean, that record they fucking killed. I mean, it's easy to say, I respect them for Melancholy, but it's like, make that a 13, 14 track album. And then it's like fucking like, then it's like, people can see that as like easily one of the greatest albums ever made. That's like, that's too long, man. I've never listened to that album fully through. It's just like too much.
So you're not going to go for like the double album.
A lot of good songs, though.
You're not going to go for the big double album for the second Freako record.
I mean, I know, definitely not for the second record. I just like, I don't know how you could do that and not feel self-indulgent. I don't know. Depends.
So had you recorded all of, you know, this album before ATO signed you?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we were like finishing mixing stuff when we had like finalized the deal.
Because, yeah, like the Suntime story said you guys signed with them in August, which is really not that long ago.
No, it was very recent. Because we were talking to a bunch of folks for a while. And then we ended up signing, and then we finished up a few of the mixes after we signed. And yeah, then we made the singles plan and everything.
Do they give you feedback? Do they say, hey, you know, remix this, bring this up, or, you know, any kind of, you know, label advice? Or were they like, hey, we're just buying what you made, and you know, we think this is really good?
Well, that was the thing, they did just let us do what we wanted to do. And like, now we're at a point, you know, where it's like, now that the album's finished, like for like some like radio stuff, it's like, oh, can we get a mix with like louder vocals? I'm like, I don't have a problem with that shit, as long as the album is out there how it is the album,
right?
That's all I care about, you know. If a radio mix needs to have a louder vocal, whatever. But no, they were very good with that, and it does feel like they're going to stay that way, because they trusted us. And like, you know, when we were talking to people about this record, like I did have this confidence in it, and like something that I've never really had before, where it's like, it really felt special when we were making it. And like, we, you know, even before we'd finish it, like I was talking this mad talk about it to all these labels when we only had the 4 songs, and 2 of them were ballads. I mean, it was Pharrell and Cardinals, like Have It. And one of the other ones that was an up-tempo one, other than Crimson Chrome, didn't even make the album because it wasn't good enough in the end. So it's like, yeah, a lot of, you know, I was really talking it up before we even had it. And we just kind of got lucky that it came together.
Yeah, Crimson Chrome, we were hearing months ago on Sirius. There was like,
yeah, it was like a year ago.
Yeah, and you know, my wife and I were like, hey, there's Freako. It's a good song too. I got this one. I saw you guys at Reckless, but this is the Chicago edition, available only at Chicago indie record stores, 300 copies, tri-color vinyl. Were you involved at all in, you know, them putting out the special vinyl edition?
Yeah. I mean, that was actually, I mean, one thing that I knew about, because I talked to Joe Shanahan, ended up becoming like, over time, he knew about me making music in like when I was 17 and stuff, but he didn't feel serious about us, rightfully so, until like the past couple years when it was a real like career thing. And he was talking about how, like, you know, Smashing Pumpkins gave out like 100 free CDs to the first 100 people out there coming to the shows. We wanted to do that for the Metro show. The label wasn't too fond of it. So we just ended up doing posters, but like anything we can do, you know, to like make, you know, we want to be a Chicago band, and like for the city, there's something to be said for like, just like Kurt Vonnegut has that whole thing where it's like, the only thing you can truly do is like focus on your community first and then build from there. And it's like, yeah, that's the truth. And it's like, if you can like, this is not me saying that we're doing that with this, because like, there's a lot of more philanthropic things we want to do specifically for Chicago, but like, you know, like trying to give focus on the city we came up in.
There's some bands that just want to get out of wherever they are, and they're like, oh, you know, we're a band of the world or whatever. But for you, it's important to be identified as a Chicago band, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, because nobody gives a shit about a band of the world. It's like people want identity, you know, to a band and to a group. And like, whether that's something that they're connected to or not, they'll just like respect that and relate to it.
Are there any Chicago bands that have had a path to success that you'd sort of like to emulate?
Oh, that's a tough question. I don't know. I'd have to think on that hard before answering. I don't want to answer that because it's just like either friends or like Smashing Pumpkins, their exact path to success. Don't want to have that, you know? So that's a pretty hard question. In general though, people envy is like, you know, like Mitski or like Sufjan, like these artists that did their own thing that were like, they did their own thing for so long. And then it just ended up catching on to wider audience because they just did it and grinded on it, you know, wanted to make good music.
Has the label talked to you about the follow-up and thought, okay, now you guys we got some big name producer we want you to work with. We want you to go in this, you know, LA or New York studio and do it. Or is it more like, you know, hey, come up with whatever you're going to come up with and we trust you.
They've already kind of made it clear that they don't want to rush us, which is awesome. I still want us to stay on our toes and be like on top of it. But I think it's just like, I think they realize like in the history of labels rushing a second record, especially if a first record does relatively well, it never works out well. And there's no reason for it, you know?
Right.
It's in this day and age, like you can keep promoting different stuff and like keep making different types of media that people can enjoy, you know, whether it be videos or like B-sides or before you make that next statement piece.
And especially when you're being introduced as a band, that first album usually has a longer rollout than if the second album, if the first album is done well, then it's sort of like, boom, you know, people know about it right away, but you're still introducing yourselves to people. And that's why you're going on these tours and it's kind of a prolonged introduction. So they're not rushing you, but have there been any talks on, hey, we want you to work with Dave Fridman. He did this great work with, you know, Spoon and this band and that band, or is it, you know, is it more like, you know, we're just going to back off on all of that stuff. And when it comes time for you guys to work on a record, then we'll have those discussions.
Well, there's been some basic talks like that because we've been initiating too. We recently were able to talk to John Congleton, because he was interested and we're probably going to do some dates with him in September, just like work on some new stuff and start. John Congleton, he did like all the St. Vincent stuff and
oh, cool, yeah.
Some Bill Callahan, and he's incredible. Cause that St. Vincent self-titled record when I was in high school, like changed my life and like how I thought about production. And like, I was like, oh, you can DI distorted guitar is like the coolest fucking sound. So that it's going to be really cool if that works out. But you know, even with that, we've talked about where like, there's so many times where a band that did their own unique thing, like we mixed and recorded this whole record ourselves and with a couple friends, it's like, if you go out and just like work with a big name producer and let that take over and just like make it all sound good and pretty and like amazing, it's just going to backfire because you need to have the songs first and then keep that unique part of it, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's all a matter of, I mean, like, it could go either way. You could find your George Martin who brings out the best in you.
Yeah.
And, you know, or you could find, you know, some, you know, or like, you know, Queen or the Cars with Roy Thomas Baker. And you're like, yeah, he helped those guys. But then you could also find someone who's going to kind of put their imprint on you. And it's like, ah, no, that sounds kind of time stamped. And like they're putting their trademark sound on your trademark sound and that doesn't work. So obviously you guys will have some sense of, you know, how comfortable it feels and whether it feels like your music, because it seems like you have a pretty, pretty good sense of what you want stuff to sound like.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely do. We kind of just want to like, and we've talked to John about this some already. And like with Jack and Scott, who we worked on this record with, we want them to be involved in some way too. And like, basically just realizing what we did with this record more, now that we're like starting a new record with like, we know who we are as a band. Versus the first record, we like realized that halfway through, I think. Like now we know who we are as a band. We know our songs and like what feels right to us. And just like enhancing that and making it sound more pristine. Like just like getting more to that point of like, you know, my favorite, I think the greatest sounding record of all time is Rock Record, is In Rainbows by Radiohead. It's like, you don't get any better than that. And so like,
I love that record.
More intense record than that, maybe, you know. Yeah, just like sonically, really like perfect, but like also really live and edgy.
I loved your Arpeggi Weird Fishes cover, by the way.
Oh, thank you. We are going to get in the studio and record that. Yeah, that was very fun.
One of the keys of being a live band is like pulling out the cool cover where you're like, all right, that's a good one. You got any other ones?
Dude, I mean, playing that song. Well, we did last time we played Metro, we did Life on Mars. We do the Glow Part 2 by the Microphones. We need to pull out some more, though. We haven't done too many. But playing Weird Fishes was just like, when we're in the middle of it, I'm like, God damn, man. This song is so fucking good. I mean, what's the type of thing where it's like, we actually, me and my dad and even mom could bond when I was like 11, when it first came out, it was like, or 10 or something. It was just like, it's just an everyone record, you know, it's definitely Radiohead's most wide ranging record.
I looked on your website and it looks like you have like nonstop shows from the beginning of April through the beginning of June. And maybe there's more after that. What's the split of you guys opening for other bands versus headlining, and how do you approach each one?
I mean, it's going to be mostly opening this year. We're doing some fests, but like almost all of our stuff, and like it's going to be mostly just opening. And then in 2025, we're hoping to do some like headlining US tour, but we're also probably going to be hitting the whole US on an opening tour again in like September. And then Europe in October and November. It's just going to be a long, crazy year, but we asked for it and I'm excited for it. I'm very excited for it.
So who are you opening for?
In April, I think it's Willis, and then Water From Your Eyes in May, in the first half of May, and then Mind's Eye in the second May. And then yeah, that's for all those tours. Yeah.
So how does that get worked out? Is it like the band, the headliner, do your people reach out to the headliner? Does the headliner reach out to you? Like, how do these sort of tours get put together?
I mean, I don't fully know the process of it, but it's through our booking agent. Basically, we'll see, like, headliners will put out fields for like, hey, looking for openers. And then our booking agent will just like submit us as looking to be the openers. And then the headliners will choose, I think.
And what's like the particular challenge when you go on stage as an opener? What are you trying to do most of all?
As an opener, it's definitely just like, you gotta like be in the audience's face, you know, and kind of just like get them to pay attention. But like, it's not like it was in the 90s, or like when my uncles used to play some guitar, who used to play music in some like smaller bands back in the day. Like, they're like, oh yeah, when we were openers, like, who would throw beer cans at us and like shout and like tell us to stop playing. It's like, it's just not like that anymore. And it's like, yeah, people might not give a shit and talk, but like, I mean, we like, our live show is very in your face. So either people are probably going to walk out of the room or they're going to be in it and enjoying it.
Do you like that challenge of grabbing their attention? Like, all right, you guys are going to listen to us now.
Yeah. I've always enjoyed that. I mean, that was like for years, that's what it was. And like, it's a whole different thing.
You know, I just wish you all the success. I hope I run into you at Music Direct when you're not touring. And any last thoughts on, you know, anything you're looking forward to?
Well, it just got announced, but Japan, we're playing Fuji Rock at the end of July. Japan has always been a dream to go to. And
wow,
that's just going to be crazy.
Yeah. And then you could have like the Freako at Budokan record coming out after, you know, in a few years.
Oh, well, we are doing like a deluxe Japan release on CD. The record like really blew up in Japan. It's really crazy. It's like bigger there than it is in the US. It's insane.
That's awesome.
I don't know why or how, but.
Well, good luck. I'll see you around Chicago again, I'm sure. And great talking to you. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Mark.
That's it for episode 129 of Caro Pop. Thanks so much to Nico Capitan for taking us inside the expanding world of Freako. The band's debut album, Where We've Been, Where We Go From Here, is widely available through ATO Records. Freako currently is on tour with Willis, playing shows in Philadelphia on April 11th, Boston on April 12th, Brooklyn on April 13th, Washington, D.C. on April 14th, and a whole lot of dates to follow, most nights up to a June 2nd show at the El Rey Theater with Mind's Eye in Los Angeles. Go to whoisfreako.com for more information about shows and links to buy the music. You can find Freako on Instagram at Freako for you. That's for you, like Prince would do it. And on Twitter at Freako O for you. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, whose talent is always crashing through. Now you can become a Carol Pop friend for a mere $24. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.